listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartmann here with you. Well, the two senators from Oklahoma who both voted against aid for Sandy seem to be provisionally in favor of aid for Oklahoma. Funny how those things work. We'll get into that as we continue through the day. Congressman Mark Pocan is going to drop by. Tim Carpenter is going to be here. Pastor Alexander Bullock about what's going on in Detroit. Did you know that there's a killer mountain of carbon in Detroit as a result of tar sands oil being burned there? Apparently it's like the fly ash from burning coal. So anyway, a lot going on, but the IRS, this IRS scandal seems to be at the top of the news. And in fact, the IRS, the former Republican Bush appointee IRS commissioner testified before the IRS today and refused to take responsibility, although did acknowledge knowing about these lists. He had resigned some time back. His term ran out. It's a 5-year term. And Obama had not yet appointed a new commissioner. But Steve Sutton is on the line with us. He's the vice president of the for development with the Leadership Institute. Leadershipinstitute.org is the website. Leadership Institute has a training program whose graduates include Senator Mitch McConnell, Grover Norquist, Ralph Reed, and drumroll, Karl Rove. And Steve Sutton, I understand you, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be with you.
I understand that you and your group were the subjects of IRS scrutiny.
Yes, we were. In fact, at the very same time that the nonprofits that were applying for tax exempt status were being looked at, we were being audited. In fact, the timeline is virtually identical, which makes us think that this is much larger than groups that were applying for nonprofit status. We've been a nonprofit since 1979, and yet we were audited during the same time frame.
You're a 501c4, right?
Nope, we're a C3.
You're a C3. So you disclose your donors, but you have tax-exempt status.
Nope, we do not disclose donors. C3s or 4s do not disclose donors. The difference is in the level of political activity that you can do. And many organizations have a C3 and they also have a C4 to allow them to do more. We do not do that. We're strictly a C3 and we have been since 1979.
So you're a social welfare organization in the same category as a hospital or a school or a community for abused kids, that kind of thing.
Or community organizers or Media Matters or Planned Parenthood. Yes.
Right. So what is the social welfare? And by the way, I get your point, and I would put the same question to David Brock, you know, if he was here. What is the social welfare that your organization does that justifies my paying taxes for your police services and fire services and other use of the commons that you don't have to pay for?
That's a great question. I think it is central to part of this debate. People, I think, understand that social welfare doesn't mean that it needs to be socialist or for welfare. Social welfare is a very broad category. And so we are an educational institution. We do training programs. We've got 40 different training programs, and we teach people to get more involved in public policy.
So you're saying essentially you're a school?
Yes, we have workshops ranging from half a day to 4 days, and that's all we do. And so there's a lot of things that are part of that, but we are a training organization. And so, but many of these other organizations, the IRS has a very broad definition of social welfare because it's very difficult, as you've stated, it's difficult. Where do you draw the line on what that means?
Well, here's one of the things I find interesting about this. One of the arguments that is made by many of your graduates, certainly people like Mitch McConnell and Grover Norquist and Karl Rove, is that we should only be that the government should only be involved in those specific things that are listed in Article 1, Section 8 and of the Constitution for which Congress can appropriate funds, you know, like, you know, roads for the postal system, that kind of thing, and or the Army.
Right.
And yet the opening of Article 1, Section 8 says Congress may appropriate funds, I'm paraphrasing, to serve the general welfare of the United States.
Right.
Alexander Hamilton, in his 1791 address to Congress on manufactures, went into a relatively long rant about how using federal funds to support emerging industries fell under the general welfare clause of Article 1, Section 8, and he was one of the guys who wrote the Constitution, and that when they wrote the Constitution, they intended for that general welfare clause to be as broadly interpreted as Congress felt the need to do, basically. I can read you the exact language, but it's damn close to that.
Right.
To give maximum latitude to Congress in present and future times to meet the needs of the general welfare. Why would there seems to be cognitive dissonance here between people who say that, you know, the Constitution saying general welfare should not be interpreted broadly, but the IRS code saying social welfare should be interpreted broadly.
Yeah. I mean, I'm uncomfortable discussing or paraphrasing the founders of over 200 years ago when there was no income tax, as we all know, and trying to read their minds as to what the general welfare and what social welfare, the distinctions between the two. But I do agree with you that this is the job of Congress, and Congress perhaps has not done the job that they need to do to better define what that means, which has forced the IRS to make very tough decisions. The problem in this case, though, is that I think it's generally agreed that the IRS did not apply the same standard in a non-political way, and that is why the Eric Holder is launched a criminal investigation. The president has called it unacceptable, intolerable, inexcusable,
right.
And so. But I don't disagree with your point, which I think is very valid, that Congress in general writes laws that lack definition, that are virtually impossible to decipher, leaving it to the regulatory agencies to do so. And
particularly with the tax code that has to do with nonprofits, which sure. basically means that all the rest of us are subsidizing you and Media Matters with our tax dollars.
Sure.
And
so also, I would add, we're also subsidizing movetoamend.org, which you recently today said that people should go to the website and sign an amendment to the
Constitution. And I'm of the opinion that most of these organizations, if they were run as for-profit corporations rather than not-for-profit corporations, probably wouldn't lose most of their donors.
I agree with that.
And
I'm vice president of development, so I deal with the fundraising here, and I don't think people donate because of that per se.
Well, in fact, most people don't. You know, the small donors don't even list this on their taxes.
Exactly. I mean,
you know, it's just
well,
not worth the trouble.
Right. Right.
And
at all.
And so, would you join me in calling for us to really seriously reevaluate our tax code and say, you know, only organizations that are doing basic, you know, kind of Matthew 25 stuff. I mean, feeding the homeless, healing the sick, you know, that basic core stuff really should be qualify for a subsidy from all the rest of us in terms of not having to pay taxes.
I think I would join you if you went as far as to say that nobody should, because it would be impossible to draw the line. That's the problem. When someone says social welfare, we could all agree on the thing that you mentioned, helping the poor and such.
Right.
But what about getting the poor to organize and register to vote, to exercise
right.
their constitutional
rights. Well, here's,
and then, so that's where that.
Yeah, then you have the problem, though, that for-profit corporations have to be designed to show a profit first rather than their, it gets complicated. Anyhow, Steve, we're out of time. I'm sorry. Steve Sutton, Vice President of Development. Hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Leadershipinstitute.org. Steve, thanks for a very civil conversation.
Okay, thank you, Tom. Take
appreciate
care.
It. Past the hour, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. It's the Tom Hartman Program, defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Okay, here's what I was getting at in the end of that conversation with Steve Sutton, and it would have been interesting had we had the time to dig into this with him. Although, but he's not here, so So I'll dig into it with me, I guess. And that is that the principal difference between a not-for-profit corporation and a for-profit corporation, at least in theory, is that the principal purpose of a for-profit corporation is to show a profit. This is capitalism 101, is to generate extra capital for the capitalists who put the initial money in to start the company. That money comes back out to them, and they go on their merry way. And then the secondary purpose of a for-profit corporation, after they've made a profit, is to do whatever they do, whether it's making cars or whether it's educating progressive or conservative activists. The principal purpose of a not-for-profit corporation, of a nonprofit organization, is to do what they do. There is no profit motive. So whether it's educating conservative or progressive activists, you just heard from Steve Sutton, he's educating conservative activists. Later on today, Tim Carpenter is going to be on. He's educating progressive activists with PDAmerica.org, which I'm quite sure is a nonprofit, 501c3. And maybe a C4, I'm not sure. We can ask Tim. But the point is that as a not-for-profit, your principal job is to do what your principal job is, because you don't have to worry about making a profit. You do, however, have to worry about making payroll. So, I mean, you know, there's budgeting for both. And I would submit to you that probably the vast majority of for-profit corporations in the United States, the small businesses, the businesses from something like this radio show to somebody who incorporates their accounting practice or their law practice or their doctor practice, that their for-profit form, they're not asking for a subsidy. They're not asking for, you know, abatement of their property taxes or sales tax or income tax. But they're also not run with their principal goal being to show a profit. They're run with their principal goal being, you know, to put on a good radio show and or to, you know, whatever it may be, to practice law. Which is why, as I was talking about yesterday, typically these small businesses, they'll zero out their profit at the end of the year. They'll come close to it so that they're not paying taxes, or at least income taxes. They continue to pay property tax, and they continue to pay sales tax and things like that. So maybe we need to come up with a third kind of entity. Or maybe we just need to clarify some of these terms. Or maybe, as Steve and I were, you know, kind of poking around the edges of, we should ask Congress to be very specific. Now, with what does social welfare mean? And who should interpret that? Should it only be the Internal Revenue Service that interprets that? Because right now they're doing kind of a clumsy job of it, shall we say. And let me restate, by the way, the irony that I think I identified here, which is sort of like the irony of Inhofe and these guys from Oklahoma. In fact, I want to rant on that just a little bit and then pick up your calls and your thoughts on these things. But the irony that these groups conservative groups that believe that the general welfare clause of the Constitution should be interpreted very narrowly, believe that the social welfare clause of the Internal Revenue Code should be interpreted very widely because it works to their benefit. And it's like, okay, where's the logic in that? Where's the consistency in that? I don't get it. Speaking of consistency, Senator Tom Coburn voted against funds to help people who were devastated by Hurricane Katrina. And now he's saying, people in New Jersey, basically. And now he's saying, he will vote for funds for those people who were harmed in Oklahoma, his home state, But only if they take away an equal amount of money in food stamps to people in New Jersey or some other variation thereof. In other words, you've got to cut government spending by the exact same amount as you are increasing spending by covering the disaster in Oklahoma. And this is not going over so well on his Facebook page. His colleague, James Inhofe, by the way, the other Republican senator from Oklahoma. Isn't it weird? Oklahoma, it's a little tiny state. It's got two senators. Anyhow, James Inhofe, the other Republican senator from Oklahoma, he who voted against Sandy relief. He's saying, relief for victims of Hurricane Sandy, that's a completely different, this is his phrase, completely different thing from voting for relief from the victims of the tornado in Oklahoma. What's completely different about it? I don't know. More liberals in New Jersey? I don't get it. But over at Tom Coburn's Facebook page, he posted, "My prayers, thoughts and prayers are with those in Oklahoma affected by the tragic tornado outbreak." And Gary Cook posts on his Facebook page, "You were elected by the same people who desperately need your help right now. Real Americans don't see red states and blue states when disaster strikes. We only see the United States. You are being tested right now, and you are failing miserably as a senator and a human being." Travis Putt says, "You're a despicable human being, insisting on spending cuts before relief? To hell with you, sir, and enjoy the weather." Candace says, "You may have well been with the looters last night, digging through the rubble of what remains of people's lives." Neil says, "Your thoughts and prayers are worthless." Mike Wilson, "You were quite literally threatening the well-being of American lives by playing politics."
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's really quite remarkable how these Republicans, money for my state, that's fine. Just take away food stamps from the people in New Jersey. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, Senator Coburn taking some abuse from his constituents. Although, if you really don't believe in the American system, if you really do hate America, you hate American government, you hate the idea of our nation being a constitutionally limited democratic republic or a constitutional monarchy, if you want to accept my characterization of the Supreme Court, if you really do hate that and you really do think that we should be, libertarian paradise in the mold of Ayn Rand, sort of like, with virtually no government and billionaires and large corporations making all the decisions, sort of like Haiti or, Somalia. Although I'm not sure the corporations are all that powerful there. But if you really do hate America the way that, James Inhofe and Tom Coburn do, I guess there's a lot of consistency to that. Screw the storm victims is their take on it. Except when it happens in their state, they got to get elected, So when it happens in their state, then they'll say, okay, as Tom Coburn has said, all right, well, I'll vote for money for Oklahoma, but only if you cut the money for food stamps to people in New Jersey or some other place. Only if you knock some kids out of preschool. Only if you, cut some Head Start programs. You got to figure some way to, reduce Medicare. Screw the elderly. Somehow. Come up with an offsetting cut. So, if you're, for the Hate America crowd, the Tea Partiers and the conservatives that don't agree with the principles upon which this country was founded, that really want to go back to the Articles of Confederation when we had 13 relatively independent and highly autonomous states that were bound together by basically a trade agreement rather than one nation with a federal government, a federalist form of government. Then I guess, for those folks, what Coburn and Inhofe are saying makes a certain amount of sense. Greg, in Enid, speaking of Oklahoma, in Enid, Oklahoma, I hope your town is okay, Greg.
Well, we are. We are. We dodged that bullet. Just my heart goes out to the folks down in Moore. Just hard to believe they got nailed again.
Yeah, and today it's raining. Another storm line just went through there, which has got to be just heartbreaking if you've survived it and you're trying to find the you know, family photos and birth certificates and things in the wreckage. Anyhow, it says you wanted to disagree with me about something.
Well, yeah. I mean, I first of all, I just want to let you know I am from Oklahoma, so chances are I am a conservative.
Okay.
But I do like your show, and I listen to you frequently. But I you kind of spun me up a little bit. I think you're kind of being disingenuous and kind of hyper partisan on this deal. First of all, you mentioned that isn't it weird how Oklahoma is a small state with two senators, and I'm sure you had a tongue in cheek when you were saying.
Well, let me give you the rest of that rant. And because we have small states with two senators, and one of those senators is a regular on this show, Bernie Sanders from Vermont. There's only 600,000 people in Vermont, pretty much like Oklahoma. Because of that, and because most of those states are not like Vermont, which is a very liberal state, they're very conservative states like your state of Oklahoma, you have 40 senators out of the 100 in the United States Senate who represent, the majority of whom represent small conservative states, who represent about 16%, if I'm remembering correctly, of the population of the United States able to kill legislation. And that seems to me wrong. Now, the solution to that, I don't think, is to strip your state or Vermont of one of its senators. I think the solution to that comes, you know, in the Constitution and then at law, where we talk about the apportionment, how many people are elected as representatives. You add historically up until 1929, we have added to the House of Representatives as our population grew. So our House of Representatives grew from, you know, 20 or 30 at the founding of the Republic to 435 now. And frankly, I think it should grow a little more. But I would submit to you that we should have something in the Constitution that says that when a state's population exceeds a certain threshold, and I would toss, you know, 15 million into the pot because that's about the size of New York City these days. When it exceeds 15 million, it has to divide. You know, it has to split, sort of like, you know, bacteria dividing, you know, meiosis rather than mitosis. And I think that California should be three states, Northern California, Central California, Southern California. I think Texas should be two states, East and West or North and South. I think Florida should be two states, Southern Florida and then Central and Northern Florida. I think New York should be two states, Manhattan and the rest of New York. And if we did those things, those, you know, very simple, straightforward things, you would have states that proportionally were more equally sized, number one. And number two, the makeup of the Senate, including the minority that can filibuster, would more accurately represent the profile of the United States of America. And I think that that would serve all of us well. So that's you know, I started to go down that road, and then I stopped myself, and it came out the way that you described, and you're right. That was very inartful. My apologies.
Well, and I don't know what world that would ever happen, but it would never happen. The reason it's set up like this is to give the smaller states equal access to the political system. Otherwise, the House of Representatives will be majority rule and.
Yeah, I'm just saying that the people in the large states are getting screwed badly. I mean, for you in Oklahoma, your vote for senator has 36 times more impact than a Californian's vote for senator.
I understand, but they have more representatives, so it's
in the House.
Yes, they have more representation in the House, and that's the genius of the system. But the other thing that I kind of took offense to, and I've met Senator Coburn. We took a trip to Washington a while back and had the privilege to sit down with him. And, you know, he's a very level-headed person. And, you know, what he's interested in is making sure that our country does not continue down the path to financial oblivion. And concerning
why then is he doing everything he can to send us to financial oblivion?
Pardon me?
why is he doing everything he can to send us to financial oblivion? I would say that he's not concerned with financial oblivion. He's concerned with socialism. He does not want us to become a democratic socialist country like Finland or Sweden or Norway or Germany or like that.
Right. Well, nobody west of New Jersey wants that. I mean, as far as, or maybe California, but everybody else in the middle does not want that.
Well, actually, not true, Greg.
Well, no, it is true.
When you ask people about specific programs, when you ask people, do you think that everybody in the country should be able to go to college for free, paid for by the government? You get responses, Democratic and Republican, that are over 70%. When you ask, do you think that everybody should have health care in this country paid for but universally by the government? You get answers, Democratic and Republican, over 70%.
Well, when I go to the ice cream shop, I want to double dip for the price of a single, but the facts are the facts, and we can't afford that. And
we're the richest country in the world, Greg. What do you mean we can't afford it?
We're $17 trillion in debt, Tom. Who is going to...
We can easily afford it, Greg. That's nothing.
Oh, my God.
When we came out of World War II, our debt-to-GDP ratio was 129%. Our debt was 129% of GDP. And you know how Republican President Dwight Eisenhower got us out of that debt?
We are going.
He borrowed money and spent it to send GIs to college and to build the national highway system. And that stimulated the economy so brilliantly that we had three consecutive decades of GDP growth of over 3%, first time it has ever happened in the history of the United States.
I can point to France. I can point to Britain. I can point to Spain. I can point to Greece. I can point to Portugal. Those socialist democratic states do not work. They have never worked.
Not true. Not true. They were working just fine until in the case, let's break this apart. First of all, in the case of the UK, they were working just fine until you got a conservative government that said we're going to impose austerity, and now they're having a triple dip recession. They own their own currency though. In the case of France, they're not doing so bad right now, thank you very much. The standard of living and the quality of life in France is much better than in the United States overall. Level of education is higher. Level of health care is better. We are like 27th in the world in most of these things. And with regard to Greece and Spain, had they never given up their own currency, they wouldn't be in the situation they're in right now. They've been screwed by joining the EU, which I've been saying from day one was a bad idea. And the only way that they're going to get out of it is by leaving the EU and going back to the peso and the drachma.
Well, I, quite frankly, probably would not disagree with you on some of those issues that you just said. I think the thing that really frosted me the most was when you said that Tom Coburn said, and I think I'm quoting you, that we're going to have to take the food out of the mouth of starving children. He didn't say that. What he said was, we're going to have to have office. And what you said these people.
No, I got it, Greg. But you would have to agree with me that Tom Coburn is no fan of social welfare programs. Greg, we're out of time. I'm sorry.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And we do have a hard clock on the show. I have no control over that. It happens at 3:45 every single day. 45 minutes past the hour every single day. My apologies, Greg. This show is underwritten in part by Aeroside. Better air, better life. Aeroside air purifier, developed by NASA, clears the air of harmful gases, household chemicals, mold, viruses, and bacteria. More information at the Aeroside banner on TomHartman.com or 800-361-7591. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And the pastor, D. Alexander Bullock, is on the line with us, back with us. He's the founder and national spokesperson for the Change Agent Consortium. Action CAC on Facebook. It's facebook.com/ActionCAC. And Reverend Bullock, welcome back to the program.
Tom, it's good to be on the program. How are you?
I am fine, and it's great to have you with us. I saw this story, Koch Brothers Killer Carbon Mountain in Detroit. Your town could be next. Kind of reminds me of the old song from the 60s when I was a kid, better look out for the eggplant that ate Chicago. If he's still hungry, your town might eat your town too. What's this giant carbon killer carbon mound in Detroit? What's going on with this? What is this?
You know what? You would think emergency management would be enough of a problem for the city of Detroit.
Yeah.
But now on top of that, we've got environmental racism. I mean, the Koch brothers have a huge mound of petroleum coke or pet coke that takes up almost a industrial city block right by the Detroit River. In fact, on the banks of the Detroit River, this is some nasty stuff. Look, you can't burn it in the United States of America. The EPA won't approve it being used as a source of fuel. And so it comes actually from Canada, but is stored on the U.S. side, right on the Detroit River. And so now we've got, you know, environmental racism, low-income communities can't fight back, don't have the big money to organize against the Koch brothers, and basically they're taking advantage of Detroit and these vulnerable communities.
Now, this mountain of crud, this it kind of almost looks like coal. This is, if I understand correctly, when you take the Canadian oil tar sands oil, which is actually bitumen slurry, it's actually kind of like ground up coal mixed with water. When you take that and refine it into gasoline and diesel fuel, what's left over is this stuff, right?
That's right. That's
okay.
Right. This is a nasty byproduct of the oil refinery process. So nasty that, again, we don't even use it in the United States of America.
It's illegal
actually
to burn it here because it's so dirty. So we, right. What do the Koch brothers do? Export it to other countries, third world countries?
Export it to China, in fact.
Wow. Where they do burn it in power plants or whatever, and it produces a whole another level of waste. So, which raises the question. I mean, they want to build this Keystone XL pipeline down to the Gulf Coast so that they can run the refineries down there so they can export gasoline and diesel fuel all around the world and make a pile of money. Are we going to end up with mountains of this, what's this stuff called?
Petroleum coke, or pet coke for short.
Pet coke. It's appropriate given the Koch brothers' name, only it's C-O-K-E, right? Like
that's right.
You know, not the drink, but more like what's left over after. We used to have coke-fired furnaces, actually. This, you know, that were to make steel and things back, you know, 50, 80 years ago. I guess that was a product of burning coal. So are we going to end up with this down in Texas?
You know, we might end up with this around the country. It's amazing that people are advocating for the Keystone Pipeline. They say it's going to create jobs, but we never really talk about the environmental cost. Typically until it's too late. President Barack Obama and others have been trying to make the United States of America greener and leaner. You know, we're trying to make Detroit one of the havens and capitals of a green economy. We're talking about geothermal heating and wind turbines and solar panels. But, you know, there's another vision potentially to have these mounds of mess all around the nation. And you know how this goes, Tom. Where will you find these mounds? You'll find them in low-income communities. Yeah. You'll find them in communities where there are poor people, where people are most vulnerable. And so, again, you have poor, disadvantaged communities potentially now suffering from environmental racism while the big oil companies continue to get richer. And something's got to stop here.
To the best of your knowledge, have the Koch brothers ever cited a refinery, ever put a refinery, particularly one that uses Canadian tar sands and produces this pet coke waste product? Have they ever put one of these in a white community?
Not to my knowledge. But the studies that we have, at least about the state of Michigan, show that the percentage of environmental racism, the percentage of dumping or storing hazardous materials is very, very high the closer you get to brown and black minority or poor white low-income communities. And so this is obviously a class issue and many times a race issue. But it seems that the most vulnerable are always those who are preyed upon by corporate titans.
Amazing. And I can't let you go without asking you, what's going on with the little dictators there, Rick Snyder's little dictator who has now taken over Detroit?
Well, Kevin Norris taken over Detroit, and we're continuing to wait and see. He hasn't made any big moves, threatened to cut the city council pay. That hasn't happened, but we're keeping our eye on the water department. We know that there is a great movement for privatization in the city of Detroit. Many agencies have been privatized already. So we're keeping our eyes on our assets in Detroit, as well as Flint and Benton Harbor and other places. And we continue to stand strong looking forward to make sure that Governor Snyder is a one-term governor, and hopefully we can get these emergency managers out of Michigan.
Does his term expire in the next year and a half?
2014, he's up for re-election, and so we're already organizing now.
Wow. That's incredible. And your best guess is that what Kevin Orr is going to do, the emergency manager in Detroit, the fellow who has ended democracy in Detroit at the behest of the governor, who passed this law after the citizens of Michigan voted down the law, he brought it back, that his main agenda is going to be to take the public utilities of Detroit, paid for by the taxpayers of Detroit, and hand those off to private for-profit buddies of his and the governor's.
That's our best guess, that the lighting department, DTE, will take over the lighting. The water department will be taken from the city and become potentially a separate corporation. They'll float some bonds, but Detroit won't control that as well. Belle Isle and other assets will be taken from the city. So that's our best guess, but we're standing strong and we're continuing to fight back.
Good on you. Reverend D. Alexander Bullock, the founder and national spokesperson for the Change Agent Consortium, ActionCAC, facebook.com/ActionCAC. Reverend, thanks again for being with us today. It's always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, Pastor Martin Niemöller warned us of the importance of speaking out when we see our rights eroding. He famously wrote about his time in the Dachau concentration camp. First they came for the communists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the socialists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a Jew. And they came for the Catholics, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a Catholic. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. End of quote. And yes, he was taken to Dachau in 38 or 39 and was liberated in 45. He reminds us of the dangers of not recognizing creeping incrementalism. When small steps are being taken to abridge our rights, and in doing so, they are essentially laying the foundation for not just larger steps, but, you know, possibly really radical steps to take away all of our rights or larger chunks of our rights. It's in his book, They Thought They Were Free, Milton Mayer. He quotes a German professor who lived through the Hitler time, who says, you know, if A hadn't led to B and B to C, he said each step was a small incremental step. And he said if they had gone right from A to D, there would have been an outcry. There would have been an uproar. So anyhow, this brings us back to what's happening right now in the media in the United States. When our founders formed our nation, they named only one industry in the United States Constitution. They didn't say that shipbuilding needs to be protected or the agriculture industry or even the arms industry. They didn't even think the legislative branch was that important. But in the First Amendment to the Constitution, our founders wrote that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. Our founders wanted to protect the press. They realized that freedom of the press was essential. They recognized that a nation could not be strong without a press able to operate outside of the realm of government oversight and control. In fact, Thomas Jefferson once famously said, "We're a quote, we're left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government. I should surely not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter." But times have changed since our Constitution was written. And today what is supposed to be a free press is under attack from our government. Slowly but surely, and I realize I'm sounding like a right-wing talk show host here, but I'm telling you, slowly but surely our government is infringing upon the rights of the media and eating away at freedom of the press. And nowhere is this more evident than in the ongoing AP leak scandal and with the new revelation that Fox News reporter James Rosen was investigated by the Department of Justice for his coverage of the State Department in North Korea. And in both of these cases, the federal government subpoenaed hundreds of emails and phone call records under the guise of national security. Now, all of this, if you want to make this partisan, we can take this back to George Bush's response to 9/11. And certainly that's where it all started, or much of it. But still, it's going on. And it almost seems like the federal government has forgotten that freedom of the press, if it's going to work, must be nearly absolute. There should be virtually no boundaries to the protection of that right. I mean, it's a sad commentary on our times when I find myself agreeing with Britt Hume, who was the protege of Jack Anderson, if you're old enough to remember him, the brilliant muckraking journalist. Britt Hume over, I'm agreeing with Britt Hume over at Fox News. But here he was last night, right on point about the federal government's recent intrusion into the workings of the press. I mean, in Fox News' special report last night, here's what Britt Hume had to say.
There are legitimate national security secrets that it is the government's job to protect. And when they leak out, the government has a right and a duty to investigate. But what the government has traditionally done in the past is to investigate the leaker and not, if you will, the leakee. And that provides the balance between the government's job to find out what happened and the press's right to pursue information. That's the way it's been done before. That's the way it seemed to have been going up until now.
Up until now. I mean, traditionally, when there were leaks to the press, the government has investigated, but it investigated the source of the leak. It didn't go after the journalist or reporter who reported on the leak. And when it did it through their organization, and they did it very publicly, like the case of Judith Miller refusing to release her sources on her reporting on Iraq and the WMDs and going to jail when she was working for the New York Times for that principle. Now, you know, I'm not no fan of Judith Miller, but that's how it was handled back then. They went to her and they said, will you please tell us who you were talking to? They didn't go through her phone records. But now it appears that our government is going after both the source of the leak and the members of the media reporting on it. And that is not only unprecedented, although I think John Adams probably would have thought it, it's unconstitutional. And this should concern us all. I don't want to end up channeling Pastor Niemöller and saying something like, first they came for the AP and Fox News' James Rosen, but I wasn't part of the AP and I didn't much like Fox News, so I didn't speak up. So I'm speaking up now. Freedom of the press needed to be protected in 1787, and it needs to be protected today. Meanwhile, Darrell Issa is running his little circus over in the House of Representatives.
Hey, we got to get to the bottom of this IRS scandal. How did we, you know, they did.
He had today the former commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service. Was appointed by George W. Bush. He was a Republican. Anyhow, he had him in front of the committee. You know,
what did you know and when did you know it?
You know, it was a IRS employee last week who kind of leaked this to the press, but ISIS acting like he's just shocked. I can't, you know, why didn't we know this before the election? Right? Like the Obama administration had to be covering this up going into November of 2012. They had to be covering it up. So today the Senate got into the act, and the Senate Finance Committee held a hearing, and the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration, a fellow by the name of J. Russell George, was called to testify. And Bob Menendez, the Democratic senator from New Jersey, as I recall. It is New Jersey, isn't it? Yeah. Shino's nodding. Must be right. He says, Inspector General, did Chairman Issa send a letter on August 3rd of 2012? Now, let's see. That would have been August, September, October, November. That would have been 4 months before the election. Inspector General, did Chairman Issa send a letter on August 3rd of 2012 to all the inspector generals reminding them that, you know, they're required to, well, here's the bottom line. Actually, rather than reading you the whole transcript, he basically said, you know, is it true that Darrell Issa knew about this? Well, here it is. The chairman Issa sent a letter on August 3rd of 2012. Informing the inspector generals that to report particularly flagrant problems to Congress to the agency head within 7 days via what has become known as the 7-day letter. Did you receive that letter? And if so, did you respond to inform Chairman Issa of your investigation of the IRS? In other words, looking into this Tea Party thing. This is in August. Mr. George says, Senator, we did receive the letter, and Chairman Issa's committee was the first to actually contact us regarding this matter, and so through the course of engaging the review on occasion, we've had communications with his staff. Menendez, in 2012? George. And since then? Yes. Menendez. Thank you. So who is the covering it up? Looks like it was Darrell Issa.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Now, maybe it was, you know, just somebody on his staff who was keeping it from him, but Darrell Issa covering up the IRS? Really? It's the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program, your media support group for We the People. Amazing, a giant carbon mountain in Detroit. Amazing. Darrell Issa was informed in August of last year that the IRS had been back, you know, 2 years earlier, had been giving the Tea Party groups that were applying for IRS tax exempt status a little extra checkout just to make sure they actually were social welfare organizations. Really? Darrell Issa covered it up? Yeah, That is what the Treasury Inspector General for the Tax Administration, the Inspector Generals, these are like the cops, right? This is the guy who's in charge of overseeing the IRS. He's the cop who investigates crimes done by the IRS. The Inspector General works for the Treasury Department, the IRS is part of, and he's the Inspector General for Tax Administration. His name is J. Russell George. Mr. George. Mr. George, did Chairman Issa send a letter on August 3rd of 2012 asking you, you know, about your investigation into the IRS? Yes, sir. We received the letter, and Chairman Issa's committee was the first to actually contact us regarding this matter, and so through the course of engaging the review on occasion, we've had communications with his staff. Mr. Menendez, Senator Menendez. And this was in 2012? Inspector General George. Yes. And since then as well. Mr. Menendez, Senator Menendez. Thank you. Right. Amazing. Marie in Carbondale, Colorado. Hey, Marie, what's up?
Well, I'm pastor of one of those churches that is feeding the hungry and clothing the naked and trying to make thoughts and prayers concrete.
Good on you, Marie.
Thank you. We're broke. We've been trying to address the needs in our community, whether it's the ongoing needs of those who've fallen through the social safety net that's totally shredded in now, or whether it's in terms of emergencies. And it seems to me like this is a good time for some trickle-down economics. It seems to me like the ones who have profited most handsomely from poisoning the atmosphere should be the ones that are stepping up to the line now to donate to all these nonprofits that they want to take care of people rather than allowing the federal government to help. They need to be contributing millions and billions of dollars now when we have these monstrous tornadoes. You know, today Will Durant from of the NBA made a $1 million donation to the Red Cross. We need millionaires and billionaires all across this country, but especially the ones of polluting corporations, to step up and take some responsibility. And I'm wondering how we can heighten their consciousness to help that happen.
It's a very simple way. You roll back the Reagan tax cuts. Put their taxes back at 73%. Of income over $3 million a year. And all of a sudden,
it would cap their earnings.
Pardon?
It would cap salaries.
That's what it would effectively. That's what it effectively did, and that's why, you know, from the 1930s until the 1980s, the CEO of the companies, particularly the local businesses, but the local businesses did very well. The CEOs lived in the same neighborhood as their employees. They, at the most, they made 30 times what their employees were making. And, you know, most of them were making 2, 3, 4, 5 times. I mean, George Romney, Mitt Romney's dad, turned down a $1 million bonus when he was head of AMC because he thought it would be unseemly. It was, you know, his salary was a couple a couple hundred thousand bucks a year. And it's like, you know, we used to get it in this country and now we don't. You're right, Marie. It is time for trickle down economics. And for me, that is just roll back the Reagan tax cuts. Let's go back to the New Deal economy, because this Reaganomics austerity economy is killing us. It has 33 years of Reaganomics has devastated this country. And you're on the front lines of that devastation, Marie. You're seeing it with the hungry and the homeless who are coming to your church, and the rest of America needs to wake up and needs to wake up fast. Marie, thank you for the call.
Thank you
very much. Jesse in Unity, Maine. Hey, Jesse, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Fine. Thanks for watching us on TomHartman.com. What's up?
I just wanted to talk about, you know, the general misconception that most of this country, and even more amazing, that most politicians have with economics. It's like they handle the economics like, you know, it's their household's income, like, oh, we're in debt, so we should stop spending, you know, let's not go out for dinner or go out to the movies, you know, handling like that instead of, I mean, yeah, I've been really getting into the modern money theory, you know, right. Stephanie Kelton, you had her on a while ago.
Yep. It even goes beyond that, Jesse. They don't even do it like household economics, because in a household, if you have a household that has an income of, let's just pull, you know, round numbers out of the air, that you've got two people working and their combined income is $100,000 a year. Typically, a bank would loan them, I mean, the old rule used to be 5 times income, so would loan them up to $500,000 to buy a house. So they've got, you know, $500,000 house. They got $500,000 mortgage. Their income's only $100,000 a year. That means that their debt is 500% of their income, and so that's, you know, that's considered conservative, right? 20% of your income is the amount that the bank would, you know, so you have these conversations with these conservatives. Is you say. And they say, oh, you know, our debt is equal to our income right now. That's our GDP. That's insane. We can't have that. And you say, well, you know, what's your income? Oh, I make $70,000 a year. You own a house? Yeah. How much is your mortgage? $250,000. Really? You know, it's like 5 times what your income is, or 4 times what your income is. You mean our debt should be 4 times GDP? We should have a debt of $40 trillion? Oh, well, I didn't mean that. And then they try to use this household metaphor again. It's crazy. Jesse, thank you for calling.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Their logic doesn't hold up. Their economic practices are devastating this country. And they're trying it in Europe. It's devastating Europe. And then even their metaphors don't hold up. Welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The tax scandal. It's amazing how we're all dancing to the tune of the Republicans, or at least across the media, and somehow we seem to have forgotten that, hey, did you know that the national debt, the rate of our deficit, as Paul Krugman was, you know, writing about this in his blog yesterday, you know, where are the deficit scolds now? You know, we were, at the beginning of the year, we were figuring that we were going to have a $1.2 trillion national debt. Or deficit, rather, this year. It would add to the national debt. And now it's down to about $600 billion. It's been cut in half, more than cut in half. I think originally it was going to be 1.35 or 1.43, something like that. And now it's in the 600. So why aren't the Republicans dancing in the streets? I mean, we're looking at deficits that are smaller than Reagan's when you inflation adjust the dollars. Where are the Republicans? Why aren't they doing high fives? No, it ain't happening. Joe in Lake Elsinore, California. Hey, Joe. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Direct Satellite TV. What's up?
Great. I'm glad I got to hear you. I've been listening to you all day, but I called specifically to mention your first speaker you had this morning. Although I did want to give a shout-out since I'm in another state. California is not three, it's one. And Darrell Issa, unfortunately, represents part of it. And
yeah.
I have the unfortunate privilege of living in his sphere. And if I could run against him, and I'd love to, but that's another topic.
Yeah.
He does know the IRS quite well from personal experiences, from what I've read.
However, I understand.
Earlier you were discussing this investigation with the IRS and the tax deductions, or should I say the ability to not claim it.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should eliminate all of those because me, the common man paying taxes for the things that I buy, the income that I earn, and then at the end of the year, I don't see where, and although, you know, it does affect the churches and it affects the hospitals and it affects a lot of worthwhile causes, but also because, or I should say in light of the United decision has to be looked at as something that it's not. You're going to say that corporations have a voice. Well, the people also have a voice.
Yeah.
And the people's voice has not been heard, at least in Darrell Issa's district, for quite some time. Now, my friend from Oklahoma had made the comment, and so I don't really want to get into the turf war, but you accurately pointed out that what the small state of Oklahoma represents by House is probably numerically as accurate as California, but the Senate, those 100 most important, if they will, voices of the people have been diluted in states that are overpopulated to the point where their voices aren't even thought. I've only been in the area here for a couple of years, heard from Darrell Issa and asked input. I've written excessively because I'm not of his party. I don't know if I get the response, but I just would suggest in that part of, in the center of the United States, the voice of the people probably isn't being heard either. It's the people that they represent.
And that's the donors.
And that's, not the representative of the people. It's the donors who pay the cash that don't even live in the state.
Yeah.
Here in California with Prop 8. I mean, this came from Hawaii all the way over from the church or the Mormon religion. That is the kind of influence that we have to try to eliminate entirely from our process, because we've got a lot, as you point out, and as we all know, problems that can't get solved because we live in the DSA, the divided states of America. We can't continue down this road in the future if we're going to be fighting little things that are just obvious. As I watch TV here in the hurricane, and we're arguing about whether we're going to help these people or not. Are you kidding me? This is America, and what social contracts that we have with the people here are still valid.
Right.
Relevant, and we need to push for more, not try to look at the people that have everything and say, gee, they're so super fortunate. Rise up the whole boat, and we'll all enjoy it. Anyways, I've had a wonderful time with your show. It's the only show that I've seen on television that I actually can call in and voice my opinion, and for that I thank you.
All right, you're welcome, and thanks for calling in, Joe. It was good to hear from you, and you made some excellent points. Michael in Brookline, Massachusetts.
Oh, hey, it's a pleasure listening to you. There's so much I agree to. But this is important, and it's not discussed. There's methods. We have an arsenal of conservation to deal with climate change, and we all know about this. But there's also an arsenal of other things that can be done. For example, you pointed out that the trees in the cities are worth $3 billion.
Yeah.
It turns out that the Food and Agriculture of the UN has papers and papers on this.
Yeah.
The planet has turned into massive increase in deserts, meaning pure dirt, no plants, life
right.
Over the last 1,000 or 2,000 years. This could be reversed.
Yeah, there was a guy who gave a TED talk on that was absolutely brilliant.
So you know about Alan Savory's talk.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that's known and never discussed. The grasslands sequester carbon.
Mm.
So he was talking about the fact that if you installed enough grasslands, we'd be back to where we were.
Yeah.
So where is the worldwide, they're efforts to mitigate climate change that I'm aware of. The guys from Super Freakonomics talked about those. But where is the Hughes efforts to install grasslands to get rid of the problem?
Yeah.
None.
Well, it's not happening because the United States and Canada have consistently essentially vetoed any effort to raise international awareness or to do anything about it at the UN. And there's this so-called debate going on in the United States about whether there's even a problem with our passing 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and having all these other forms of carbon in the atmosphere like methane that is, you know, escaping from our gas wells, from all this fracking and stuff. It's the disinformation campaign that have been funded by the Koch brothers and by the big oil companies, the other oil barons, have effectively shut down that discussion. And so Savory's comments about how if we were to reverse desertification, we would actually sequester carbon. We'd be pulling down we could drop back below that 400 ppm number at the same time as we're moving to a green and solar economy, a no carbon economy or a low carbon economy, and stop the increase in temperatures. I mean, those things are just not making it into the national dialogue. After he gave the TED talk, and I saw it one weekend, I came in here and we talked about it on Monday on the radio and TV program, but. You're right. There is a lot, and there are other ways to sequester carbon as well. That's short-term sequestration. Long-term sequestration is pulling carbon out and turning it into calcium carbonate, turning it into lime, you know, turning it into chalk, turning it into seashells, you know, things that have, you know, hundreds or thousands of years of sequestration life rather than just, a couple of years or dozens of years. And we need to be doing all of the above. Michael, thank you for the call. Excellent point. Martin in White Earth, Minnesota. Hey, Martin, what's up?
Oh, hello, Tom.
Hello, Martin.
I appreciate this opportunity. I guess I could talk about a lot of the issues you covered this morning about the free...
Please pick one.
...taxation. But what I'm calling about is... has to do with, you talked about the little dictator, the person from Detroit.
Yes.
What's going on in the city of Detroit.
The so-called emergency manager, yeah.
Yes. Well, we have a similar situation here on the White Earth Indian Reservation where we have a constitution that limits the authority of the officials, and they've gone ahead and... took advantage of the Tribal Law and Order Act. By the way, the state of Minnesota is a public law 280 state, so it isn't like there is no law enforcement here.
Mm-hmm.
But the big problem is that there hasn't been consent by the people for them to take this on. And we're really concerned
Excuse me, Marvin. What is this that you're talking about that's being taken on?
The Tribal Law and Order Act, which was passed in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
White Earth's the first one to take the issue on. I mean, adopt it.
Okay.
And all it does here is add another two layers of law enforcement for the federal government and the tribal government. The state already has authority, criminal jurisdiction.
Okay. We just have a little less than a minute left, Marvin. What's your call to action? What is the net of this?
Well, I guess I would like this looked into and see the unconstitutional methods mm-hmm. that have been utilized to bring this on.
Okay.
Nobody is aware of it. It has been spoken to lightly.
What is the name of the act again?
The Tribal Law and Order Act.
The Tribal Law and Order Act. Okay. I'm going to look into this. And we'll see what we can find out. The Indian Holocaust is rarely discussed. You guys have been the victims of a savage destruction across this country, and it continues. I will check it out, Barbara. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back in just a moment. It's 45 minutes past. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in with Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, to find out what's going on in the world. This report brought to you by Goats for the Old Goat, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and receive a photo, literally a slave. This is a practice that Sudan has been doing with regard to the people of South Sudan for a long, long time. And receive a photo of your goat and the person you helped, and you can do that at goatsfortheoldgoat.com. And the old goat herself, Ellen Ratner, and that's not an insult. That's you came
right
up with this name.
The old goat is here, and I have to tell you, in the category of you can't make this stuff up, Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, defended his multinationals and profits going through Irish subsidiaries. He said that this is the country's largest income taxpayer. He said, we pay all the taxes. We don't rely on tax shelters. Well, Carl Levin said they were the holy grail. This is Apple computer. The holy grail of tax avoidance. He said they were highly developed. They had developed a highly developed tax avoidance system, 100+ billion offshore. Now, of course, John McCain sort of agreed with Carl Levin, but sort of didn't. He said they violated, Apple violated the spirit, if not the tax laws. But Congress was at fault for not simplifying the tax code. And then the piece de resistance for the day was our friend, Senator Rand Paul. He said that we were bullying one of the greatest business success stories and that Congress should be on trial.
Wow. Now, my understanding is that in Ireland, the law is that a corporation pays taxes wherever their principal place of business is. And in the United States, the law is you pay taxes wherever you're incorporated. So Apple has incorporated in Ireland, but they keep their headquarters here. So
that's
in Ireland,
correct.
They don't have to pay taxes because their headquarters aren't in Ireland. And here they don't have to pay taxes because they're an Irish corporation.
And that's exactly it, plus their $100 billion with a B offshore.
Right, right.
You can't not make this stuff up. Now, I just want to say one thing. They're all the press is like obsessed with the IRS tech scheme and all that kind of stuff. But I've got to tell you, why hasn't the press looked into Apple? Why the IRS didn't look into Apple?
Right. Instead of the Tea Party.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Good.
Some other things going on, just in the can't make this stuff up category as well. Senators Colburn and Inhofe, both of Oklahoma, who voted against Sandy relief, are now saying that they were all saying yesterday, Colburn was saying, yes, there should be offsets against any money that was spent. Now they're saying, oh, this should be immediate relief, and they're not too worried about offsets. Funny when it happens in your backyard, how you change your tune.
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, did you catch the Menendez the hearings in the Senate?
I didn't catch those.
This falls into your same category of you can't make this stuff up. Menendez had in front of him today. And I'm looking for my piece of paper on it. Oh, here it is. Oh, no, it's not. Anyhow, Menendez had in front of him the Inspector General for the IRS, the guy who's overseeing the IRS.
Oh, I did get that. I'm sorry, I didn't know it was called Menendez hearing. You mean when he had a Douglas Sherman before him?
No, this guy was last name was George, and he said, did you receive a letter from Darrell Issa in 2012, before the elections, in August of 2012, asking for information about this inquiry into the IRS and, you know, this whole Tea Party thing?
Right.
And the guy says, yes. And he says, did you answer him? And he says, yes, back in 2012. Darrell Issa has known about this since before the election. And he's running around saying that we're just learning about it now because the Obama administration has been covering it up because they didn't want it to come out in the election.
Why am I not surprised?
Amazing.
At all. But they did also have Douglas Shulman before it. He said that there was no targeting that he knew about when he was appointed by the Bush administration. He regretted that this was happening, but he would not apologize He basically said, well, he regretted that it happened on his watch.
Right. That was in the House. That was the testimony in the House.
Yeah. So, yeah. Right. So two different hearings.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, let's go on to Syria. It looks like in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, this was also Menendez, this committee, Menendez is busy today, I guess, that they have voted to arm Syrian rebels against, this is Senate Foreign Relations 15-3. They want to have military training for groups that are vetted groups. They want to give them lethal and non-lethal weapons. So just in case you're wondering what we're doing with Syria, we're increasing our presence.
Oh, my. Okay.
I mean, the news, I don't even know how to say it, but it's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. The other today, Mitch McConnell, you know, they're hammering out the immigration bill before the congressional recess next week, Memorial Day recess, if you can believe it, we're already at Memorial Day. Mitch McConnell said he will not block the immigration bill. So I guess that's good news.
I mean, this is the immigration bill that has the trigger in it that requires the red state border governors to certify that the fence is 100%
right.
Non-permeable.
It's not a great bill by any stretch of the
imagination. I think it's a joke, but
yes, but it's going to get through at least
yeah.
the Senate. Okay. Now today there were hundreds of low wage workers walked off the job. They're asking for an executive order from the president that federal contractors got to pay a living wage. Low wage in Washington D.C. is determined at $12 or below, and they're calling themselves Good Job Nation. Now, this afternoon, just as we're speaking now, Keith Ellison, Eleanor Holmes Norton, and believe it or not, Steny Hoyer are having their own hearing. Of course, they can't make it a House hearing because that has to be controlled by the Republicans.
Huh. So they're looking into this. Do you remember the name of the act that requires the prevailing wage? It's named after somebody.
Is that Taft Hartley?
No. It's not. It might. Well, maybe it's part of Taft Hartley. It could be. But federal projects have to pay prevailing wage. We'll have to track it down. Are you in town tomorrow, Ellen?
I am not.
Okay.
What?
All right. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
And goatsfortheoldgoat.com.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 7 minutes past the hour. This Apple thing I find fascinating. And not because it's just Apple or, you know, my iPhone cracked and they won't replace my screen. I've got to buy a whole new phone or, you know, we all have our complaints, right? It's not that. Actually, if the last three iPhones I've gotten, one had a bad antenna, one had a bad battery. I don't know. But generally, they make pretty good products. I don't have much of a complaint with Apple. Other than that, I didn't buy their stock back in the 80s when we were using their products at an ad agency. I should have known. Anyway, the question is, should corporations be paying their fair share of taxes? What is their fair share of taxes? I mean, you know, Rand Paul saying Apple shouldn't be on trial here. The U.S. government should be on trial. Rand Paul apparently not a fan of the U.S. government. That being the case, one has to ask the question, why is he part of it? Right? I don't get it. Why don't libertarians just like go buy a country someplace and move there? It's like, you don't like the government? Okay. Cool. Don't be part of it. But no, we don't see that happening. So instead, they're playing this little game. These guys, they're playing this little game where they're saying, okay, we're incorporated in Ireland, and so we don't have to pay taxes to Ireland because that's not our principal place of business, but that is where we're incorporated. our principal place of business is in the United States, but we don't have to pay taxes in the United States because we're an Irish corporation. And this is where it gets really fancy, and I would guess that probably this is where most of it goes on, is, you know, a company like Apple's big enough to actually have a bunch of divisions and move tax liabilities around, and they sell to themselves. They're big enough to sell to themselves. So say you make a phone in, and now these are just made up numbers, right? In fact, we shouldn't even use Apple as an example. Let's just say some generic phone manufacturer, because Apple makes a whole lot more than phones, or some generic computer manufacturer, or some generic refrigerator manufacturer. And they manufacture their refrigerators in Malaysia, where they don't have to follow strict environmental rules. They can pollute the air as much as they want. They can dump toxic chemicals into the water and the soil. Nobody cares. They buy off the local officials. They don't have to worry about noise standards. They don't have to worry about worker safety standards. They can exploit their workers. They can threaten them. They can fire them, for the smallest infraction. And they can pay them diddly-do. So they've got... And the country is supplying infrastructure. The country is supplying them with roads and bridges and high-speed rail and good internet access and a decent port so that they can ship their goods out of the country. And not charging them much by way of taxes. And so what they do is they manufacture this refrigerator let's say it's going to retail in the United States for $250. And they make it in Malaysia, and let's say that their manufactured cost is $50. Now, here's the question. Does this company, let's say that they have a couple of divisions. They have a manufacturing division and a retailing division, and they operate them as separate corporations, all under the same name. Does this company sell its refrigerators that it cost them $50 to make in Malaysia, do they sell them to the U.S. division to sell in the United States for $50? No. Because if they did, then the company in the United States is buying a refrigerator for $50. They're selling it for $250. They're showing a $200 profit on each refrigerator, and they're going to get taxed on that profit. So what do? You got a refrigerator that's going to retail for $250. They sell it to them for $240. Now, where's the profit? It's in the Malaysian company. It's not in the American company. And by keeping that profit offshore in a country that's not going to tax it, they get to sit on this money. And then they come to the United States and they say, you know, we want to buy back our stock, or we want to build a new factory, or we want to give our stockholders a dividend. This is what Apple did this year. We want to give our stockholders a dividend. But we don't have the spare change sitting around. We don't have the cash because the cash is all overseas. So let's float a bond. Let's borrow money at a very low rate, 1%, 2%, because interest is cheap right now. Let's borrow a couple $1 billion. It'll be a very low rate because there's no risk to this bond because we're going to secure it with our offshore cash. We'll put that up as collateral. So if our bond goes bad, people can ding our Malaysian checking account. We'll float a bond for a few $1 billion, and we'll use those billions of dollars to give money to our stockholders. This is what Apple did just a few months ago. This is globalization on steroids. What globalization has allowed these companies to do is to say, we no longer have loyalty to any country. We're not a Malaysian company. We're not an American company. We're not an Irish company. We are above all that stuff. This is genuinely Ayn Rand material. This is Atlas Shrugged on steroids. And they're saying, we don't give a rat's patootie about America and Americans. Come on. That's not, our job is to show profits. It's to make money for our stockholders. And our stockholders might be in the United States. Our stockholders might be in Ireland. Our stockholders might be in Malaysia. They might be in China. They might be in England. They might be in France. They might be in Germany. They could be all over the world. It doesn't matter. Our job is to make profit for our stockholders. And this concept that has held for hundreds of years since the corporate form was invented, the modern corporate form was invented in 1600, December of 1600, Queen Elizabeth I incorporated in the United Kingdom the British East India Company. About 10 years earlier, she had created arguably the first limited liability corporation to fund Sir Francis Drake, the Golden Hind. He's going to travel around the world and map the world and discover treasures and all kinds of goodies. And so she put together this corporation where basically the investor's liability was limited to whatever they put in. Thus, it's called a limited liability corporation. So you put in, you know, 10,000 pounds, the most you could lose is that 10,000 pounds. Even if Sir Francis Drake, you know, blundered into France and started a war and ended up costing his company hundreds of millions of pounds, the investors, their limit of liability would be 10,000 pounds. That's the modern corporate form. Even then, the corporation was a creature of the state of the United Kingdom, and it worked on behalf of the United Kingdom as well as on behalf of itself. And so you had the Golden Hind. You had Sir Francis Drake to the benefit of the British. You had the British East India Company to the benefit of the British. Now, they screwed us. You know, we fought a revolution to get rid of the East India Company. But they were operating on behalf of their national interests. What has happened to this idea of a company operating in the interests of the country in which it exists? In the interests of the people who are its customers? What's happened to this? It's been devoured by this Ayn Rand logic that profit is more important than country, that patriotism counts for nothing. This is why Rand Paul, this libertarian concept, this is why Rand Paul in the United States Senate today was saying that we should be investigating the government, not Apple. Because governments are now the anachronism. We don't need governments anymore. We need more corporations running things, owning things, telling you how to live.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Like healthcare corporations, for example. We'll be talking to Tim Carpenter a little later on the show about that one. Stick around. All right. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tim Carpenter is with us, the National Director of Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org. Tim, welcome.
As always, Tom, thank you. Another month has passed, and we're still pinging the pavement and banging on the doors. Thanks
okay,
for having us over.
And you've got a national gig going on today.
Yeah, last month, the big news for everybody, to thank everybody, the listeners, and to you specifically, we were in 210 congressional district offices delivering our letter, Save Social Security, Single Payer, Robin Hood tax. So a week later, we're back knocking on the doors here in Washington saying, we delivered the letter in your district office. Now what's going on? And we had a roundtable, what we call the PDA Progressive Roundtable, in which Keith Ellison, the co-chair of the Progressive Caucus, spent about an hour with us to really go over where we are and all of that. So we've had a really good day on the Hill.
That is marvelous. And in fact, I was over at the Hill this morning. We did an interview with Mark Pocan.
Yeah. His staffer came in and we were laughing, saying, as we're meeting right now, Mark Pocan's on Tom's show and we're going to be at the back end of it today. So
right.
Mark's staff was with us as well to talk about the Voting Rights Amendment.
Yep.
We covered a lot of that as well.
Yeah. Okay. That's great. And how is it going? I mean, what kind of response are you getting from these members of Congress?
The good news is that people very much want to be engaged and be a part of something that's going to move this debate. We got to get off this austerity and get on to prosperity.
Right.
What we're finding in districts where historically, if we were able to cover 75 to 100 districts, we felt very well. In less than a month, over an additional 100, people very much want to be a part of this. The question, of course, is, will the members come forward? Danny Davis out in Illinois just came back on to 676. So we've got to get our allies back on some of this legislation.
Right.
We're realistic. We know it's not going to pass. The important thing, though, is to get the co-sponsors, force these debates, and have these discussions. It's one thing to point to this legislation. It's another to build a movement. So we're here to make sure the legislation's there. Then we're also here to make sure that the movement, the outside piece, as part of the inside-outside piece. And that's growing, Tom. We had people in the streets on the Robin Hood tax up in San Francisco. Francisco that were marching from Dianne Feinstein's office to Pelosi's office. So people are on the move.
That is incredible. And it's really important to point out and or remind people that no political change, no genuine, meaningful, revolutionary political change has ever happened in the history of the United States without a movement driving it.
Well, if you're going to wait for Congress to do anything, it's going to really affect our lives. You're going to be waiting a long time.
That's right. PDAmerica.org, by the way, is the website.
Thanks, Tom. No, we always remind folks that every great social movement, as you said, it's got to begin in the streets, going all the way back to Seneca Falls and to Rosa Parks and Dr. King. We've got to light that flame on the streets and bring it up here.
Going all the way back to Tom Paine and the crisis, and these are the times that try men's souls. You know.
Well, if we have time, we could roll it all out. There's a rich history there.
Indeed.
Inside, outside.
Indeed, there is. So how are you doing, Tim?
I'm doing fine. I've got we're very excited up in Los Angeles. We got an event coming up that we're very proud that you'll be joining us with Lily Tomlin. We're making plans for that.
That's
at the same time,
weeks.
I've got a few medical problems that I'm dealing with that are going to require me to step back a little bit from the PDA side, but dealing with those head on and finding a lot of support for that. So I'm being challenged on two fronts. Make sure we have a full house for you when you get out to Los Angeles, and then I'm going to deal with some health challenges myself
right.
in the coming weeks.
And the Los Angeles thing is, it's a week from Saturday, do I
July 1st. I'm going to go for it right now. I'm going
June
to flank it. June 1st, excuse
June
me.
1st,
yeah. June 1st, Saturday night. Tom, you're going to be joined by Lily Tomlin. Mimi Kennedy, our national co-chair, is going to host you, along with John Nichols from The Nation magazine, and Jim Hightower is going to be coming in from Texas, a former agricultural commissioner. And we're going to have a night of celebration on that night, and we're very honored that we're going to get you outside the D.C. Beltway and back into the community of the progressive community of Los Angeles.
Wow, being on stage with Lily Tomlin, I mean, and John Nichols, who gives a speech like no, you know, he's the best politician who's not a politician.
Hey, you
that
have
I've
to follow him, not
life.
Me.
Yeah, I'm just sitting here thinking, oh man, this is going to be a challenge.
It's the A team.
But okay, so how do people find out about this? PDAmerica.org.
Good place to start. Go to the events page, link on right there, and all the information's right there for folks to be a part of that event.
Okay. And PDAmerica.org, and that's a week from Saturday, June 1st.
Yes, June 1st, not July 1st. Yeah, thank you.
June 1st. And where is it in Los Angeles?
It's in Beverly Hills. We're going to be in some swanky neighborhoods up in Beverly Hills.
Cool. And this is a fundraiser for the movement. And then again, PD America is not the Democratic Party. You got no affiliation with the Democratic Party. It's about pushing Democrats. Go ahead.
Dispel all of those myths that we are part of the Democratic Party. We are the insurgency. This money will go to fund our prosperity, not austerity campaign. Every month, PDA, over the course of the last 2 years, has organized at the grassroots level to deliver the letters that we spoke of. And now with the roundtable, we're very proud tonight. We're celebrating our 6 months. So this money helps us to allow us to get the information out there to mobilize and make sure we're here in Washington. So it should be a great night. Earlier in the day for the proletariat, that's the more high dollar one that you'll be at. There'll be another event earlier in the day for folks that might not be able to do that. So there'll be two events in Los Angeles. So we think we're going to throw the net out long enough that everybody can join us. So there'll be two great events in Los Angeles. All the information's on PDAmerica.org, and we hope that people in the greater LA area can join us.
Yeah. Progressive Democrats of America, one of the genuinely independent organizations. Am I on your advisory board or on your board? I'm on some kind of a.
We've got you surrounded. I think this is your fifth year, Tom.
Okay.
You've been serving on our advisory board with.
Yes.
You've got some good luminaries up there with you from Congressman Jim McGovern, Congressman John Conyers, Medea Benjamin on the outside, but you've been with us all the way.
She's spectacular, Medea. We did a conversation with Great Minds last week with her.
I got a lot of hits on the media, on our social media, your Great Minds series. That was great.
Yeah.
Thank
you.
She's doing great work.
Yeah. We've got to get you doing that too. It's
whenever
you got to be here on a Friday night. That's
all right. We'll see what we can do.
Organize that. So people who you said three issues. Are these the only three issues that PD America is working on? And quickly recite them again.
We encourage folks to go to the website. We're organized around what we call seven principal issues that at the grassroots level we're driven by our grassroots. Our chapters have come together and basically prioritized. The three I spoke of were the focus this particular month because of the threat in regards to the prosperity, not austerity budget, but very much in addition to that, we've been very out front working with Congresswoman Barbara Lee on getting all U.S. military out of Afghanistan in a swift, orderly fashion since we were in our inception, beginning with Iraq and now with Afghanistan. Do a lot of work on the Pentagon waste, do a lot of work on redirecting military spending to meeting human needs. Met with Barbara Lee, as we said today, to work on the upcoming upcoming appropriations, what we can do there, make sure we don't get another war in Iran in our spare time. So we have an entire team committed to what we call ending wars and occupations, redirecting military spending. The climate issue, as you know, has been at the forefront. Yeah. You wouldn't know it today to talk to anybody that we actually do have a problem, that there really is something there. That's the other key issue, at clean elections, making sure that we level the playing field and we get public financing, overturn Citizens United. Just a short list.
You're
of
listening
the issues
to the Tom
with.
Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
That's Tim Carpenter, Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org. Get over there right now and check it out. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, as always. So,
it's the good, the bad, and the very, very audaciously ugly, the good. The Vermont state government. At 2 p.m. on Monday afternoon, the Vermont governor signed into law a bill that legalized physician-assisted suicide in that state. The Death with Dignity law allows terminally ill Vermonters to end their lives at their own volition and provides legal amnesty for physicians who help with life-ending procedures. Vermont is only the fourth state after Montana, Oregon, and Washington to allow physician-assisted suicide and is the first to do so through its legislature alone. The ability to democratically confront complicated issues like end-of-life choice is the mark of a mature and wise society. Good work, Vermont. The bad. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican from Iowa. During the Monday Senate debate on immigration reform, the senior U.S. Senator from Iowa needed a little help from his colleagues to understand racial profiling. After Illinois Senator Dick Durbin blasted Grassley for proposing an amendment that would allow federal officers to, quote, take into account an individual's country of origin, end quote, during immigration proceedings, the Iowa senator responded by asking, what does country of origin have anything to do with profiling? Really, Senator Grassley? You're a 32-year veteran of the Senate and you don't know the answer to that question? Dick Durbin eventually explained the connection to his colleague, but all in all, this was just an embarrassing and disturbing moment for the Iowa senator. And the very, very ugly Les Kinsolving. In yesterday's WorldNet Daily, the conservative pundit compared homosexuality to bestiality in a comment titled, Why not an additional B to LGBT? He wrote, if lesbians, male homosexuals, bisexuals, and transsexuals should have the right to marriage licenses, as a few states, including Maryland, now provide, why should the real animal lovers whose orientation is bestiality not be allowed to marry? Really? It's 2003 and you're still making these comparisons, Les? That's just very, very ugly. It's not 2003, 2013, excuse me. I mean, even in 2003, it was very ugly. It's amazing. The year we started the show. Here it is, 2013. Man, how time flies. It's amazing. Charles in Opa-locka, Florida, watching or listening on TuneIn Radio. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hi, good afternoon. How you doing, Tom?
I am great, but I'll get better, Charles. How about you?
Well, it's great to finally speak to you. I've been listening to you for years off and on,
mm-hmm.
and I just love everything that, I mean, every time I get on here and I get a chance to listen to you, you know, I always learn something new.
Well, thank you. I learn a lot myself, actually, doing this show for my listeners. By the way, it's the Davis-Bacon Act. Earlier, I had a caller. All right, I was talking with Ellen Ratner, and I was trying to remember what is the law that requires federal government, when the federal government puts out contracts, to pay the prevailing wage. In other words, a good union wage, and it's the Davis-Bacon Act for those. So we've had a bunch of callers call in and say, you know, that act he can't remember. It's the Davis. So thank you all for that. But back to you, Charles. So you wanted to talk about?
Well, just to elaborate on the Davis-Bacon Act, I can remember when after Katrina, the Bush administration suspended it, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they could bring in cheap labor to rebuild. You're absolutely right. I'd forgotten about that.
Right. I mean, this wasn't part of my topic, but just to be honest with you, as an African American living in Miami, where the population of Hispanics is like rose exponentially, it's hard to find work here. And I blame the Republicans for that, because part of this country's history is cheap labor or forced labor.
Sure.
And I think the way that they pushed us out of the way was to get the, you know, let's just be honest with you, the Mexicans come and do the work, and, you know, they turn a blind eye to their papers or whatever, and that kind of, that's like cheap labor. That's like slave labor.
Yeah, I don't disagree. After Ronald Reagan basically gave amnesty to 5 or 6 million Hispanics, largely Hispanics, a whole variety of other people. I don't think that this is so much a specific race issue as just, you know, a general issue. After Reagan gave that amnesty, he basically stopped enforcing the law that makes it a crime to hire somebody in the United States who's not a U.S. citizen. I have worked in and drawn a paycheck in Australia and Germany, in addition to the United States. And in both those countries, I had to spend months getting permission from those governments in those countries to draw a paycheck in those countries. Even though the one in Australia was just, you know, 3 days of I was giving speeches, I had to go through months and months of getting basically a work permit. And it used to be that way in the United States, and Reagan stopped that in the mid-80s. And I've been saying all along, we don't have an illegal immigrant problem. We have an illegal employer problem. And when they start throwing a few rich white guys in jail who are employing people who are not in this country legally, whether they're not legally from Mexico or whether they're not legally from France, I don't care. Still, when they start doing that, you're going to see illegal people in this country illegally start leaving this country. I realize it sounds like Mitt Romney's self-deportation thing, but I think that there's some truth to it. And I think there's some truth to your comment that by diluting the labor pool, what Reagan's policies did was they drove up poverty in the United States. They drove down wages, particularly in sectors like meatpacking and construction. And net hasn't necessarily been a good thing for American workers. And it gives the employers the power to say to these employees who are here illegally that they will turn them over to ICE because they know that the employer knows he's never going to go to jail, right? So he threatens them and forces them to, you know, take lousy wages or sometimes not even get paid. Or, I mean, there's all kinds of horrors that are associated with this. Back to you, Charles.
Well, of course. I mean, to be honest with you, I can remember, well, this was this was so long ago, but I can remember as a little kid, you know, in my neighborhood, listening to those older guys, and this is exactly what they were saying. It's like a revelation come true, but it's something that was thought out and was planned because it's already been done here. It was done to us as far as African Americans. We were slaves, and you know, once that was abolished, it's not about being. It's not about a racist thing right now. Mm. It's not about being black and white. They use that. Trust me, they use that to their advantage as well. But it's about people that have money and the people that don't.
Yeah, this is a class warfare that's going on. There is a racial component to it for many of the people who are driving it, but there's mostly it's all about the money. You're absolutely right.
The racial aspect to me is just their propaganda. That's what they use to keep their base in line and to get them riled up as well.
Yep.
But the sad thing about it is, how can you get these people over here and then you want to kick them out, you know, after we hit rock bottom? That's not American to me.
Yeah.
And that's why we have to stand up. But that's the reason why I called in, though, is I just think that right now they're trying their very best. You have all this these fake scandals, and I was looking. I watched Fox.
You have my sympathies.
Well, you got to keep your eyes on them. And basically, they stopped most of the coverage of Oklahoma, while NBC has kept up, you know, the coverage going on. I haven't checked CNN, but Fox is harping back on the narrative that Obama is the problem, and he, for whatever reason, knew the stuff was going on. And as you, with the IRS, as you pointed out earlier, you know, most of the Republicans already knew that. But it's always a fake controversy, and we're also helping them to keep our eyes off the prize, which is jobs.
Yeah.
And they don't mind wrecking this economy, because I think most Republican, I don't know if it's just senators or or a congressman, but I think they have their money in other companies across the world, across the, you know, this global economy. And I think they wouldn't mind wrecking our economy because they stand to make a profit. Now, they fight on the EPA and they fight the unions, but these are the things that help build this country and make it special. above other countries. And if you can reduce what we have to try to build up those other countries, the sniffing at our heels and wants to have the economic progress that we have, then that's the problem right there.
Yeah. I think it's Gary is one of our regular callers. He says greed has no heart, you know, it's and no soul and apparently no nationality. You know, it doesn't care. Charles, I think you've nailed it. And let me tell you, the Republicans are trying to wreck the economy, and it's a twofer for them. And there's two reasons why they're trying to do it. Number one is if they can wreck the economy in a way that causes everybody to say, hey, the economy was wrecked during the Obama administration, then guess who gets the blame? And secondly, if they can wreck the economy, and they've been doing a really fine job of this ever since Reagan came into office. I mean, 33 years of Reaganomics, it's just gone on to steroids since Bush. If they can wreck the economy and basically throw about three quarters of the middle class into the class of the working poor, you've got people who now are so busy just trying to make their rent that they're no longer, they don't have time for marches, they don't have time for political activity, they don't have time to be what the Republicans would think of as troublemakers. And so that's the way it goes. Charles, Shano tells me that you are going to get a copy of Rebooting the American Dream by Tom Hartman, autographed, if you'll hold on. Is that all right with you?
You're one. That's all I can tell you.
Okay, hang on just a second, Charles. He's on line three, Danielle. And Charles, she's going to pick you up and get your address information. This is compliments sent to you, compliments of stamps.com. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Rebooting the American Dream being my book that has the 11 policy points to rebuild America, starting with trade. It's Viagra for your brain, the Tom Hartman Program. Just don't tell Limbaugh, he'll want some. Danette in Hinesville, Georgia. Hey, Danette. Thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I wanted to let you know that my husband retired from the military after 24 years of service on the 28th of February. And we are potentially going into foreclosure because the VA is taking so long paying my husband's benefits.
Oh, no.
And that's the thank you for 24 years of service from our great government. I just thought, you know, hey, somebody should know that. And the thing is that there's nothing we can do about it.
You need to call Bernie Sanders' office, and also you need to call the office of your member of the House of Representatives, whoever represents you in Congress. But Bernie is the chairman of the Veterans Affairs Committee in the Senate, and if there's anything that can be done, his office would know. And you might want to just first look over at sanders.senate.gov at his website. I know he's got a lot of information for veterans there.
Okay, well, I will certainly do that. I knew calling you would make some sort of a difference. I mean, it's just the thought that, you know, right now we're in something called a home preservation review process, which is looking at modifying our loan.
Right.
But we can still go into foreclosure. And that to me makes no sense. If we're doing everything we're supposed to do by turning in documents and they're processing, you know, so that we can potentially have our loan modified, why would they allow that to happen? That to me makes no sense.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is happening to veterans all over the United States.
Yeah.
And it's a shame. Thank you so much, the United States of America.
Yeah, this VA backlog is a national disgrace, and it's something that the Bush administration should have seen coming. If they're going to start these wars, they should have at the same time thrown a whole bunch of money at the VA to say, you know, these soldiers are going to come home. And instead, they didn't. I mean, instead, it's the Republican austerity. And now we've got a VA that's swamped and dysfunctional and as you correctly point out, not paying benefits in a timely fashion, and it's causing a crisis. So, but start there. Start with your local member of the House of Representatives and call Senator Sanders' office and ask, and tell him you listen to Brunch with Bernie on the show and ask if they have any suggestions, where you should go, who you should talk to. I'd be surprised if they didn't. And let us know how it works out. Okay, Danette?
I will. Thank you so much.
Okay, good luck. Sharon in Bellingham, Washington, listening on KBAI. Hey, Sharon, what's up?
Well, a while ago you had a Native American gentleman call in and talk about the Holocaust of the Indians. And I've been reading a book thinking that this is kind of a lost thing among all the other immigration things and stuff. It's like you never hear the Indians being mentioned. And I'm reading a book by Frank Waters called Braver My People. And it's about different Native American leaders back in the day. And because you know so much about Jefferson, I'm really concerned about something written about Jefferson in the chapter on Tecumseh. And it basically states that the policy of President Jefferson was to expand exterminating Indian tribes and then claim their territory of every extinct tribe according to the doctrine of paramount sovereignty.
Yes, that's
true. And it talks about luring the treaty chiefs into debt so that when they're too in debt to pay back their lands, they have to secede their lands to the white people.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, you say so much good about Jefferson, and I read that, and it just made me sick.
Yeah. Well, this was the time. I mean, Jefferson was also a slave owner. He was not a perfect man. He was far from perfect, and his administration was not a perfect administration. And those, by the way, were not just the policies of the Jefferson administration. They were the policies of the George Washington administration, the John Adams administration, the Thomas Jefferson administration, the James Madison administration. I mean, arguably, those are the policies right now of the Barack Obama administration. We have never stopped screwing the Native Americans in this country. We committed a genocidal holocaust against them that lasted for, you know, 200-300 years at least, and we are continuing those practices in far more subtle ways. But the highest levels of tuberculosis in this country are on Native American tribes. The highest levels of unemployment in this country are on Native American tribes. The highest levels of rape and child abuse within interfamily violence are on Native American tribes. And these are all reflections of the poverty that has been inflicted on these people by white people by and large. And, you know, we sit around talking about immigrants and we're immigrants. I mean, we're the ones who came and stole their lands. You're absolutely right. So,
and it seems like a subject that doesn't get addressed very much.
You're right. It doesn't, because we killed so many of them off that there's not that many to speak out and make it a topic that anybody pays attention to, which is a tragedy. So, Sharon, thank you for raising the issue, and thank you for bringing it up, because it needs to be brought up more often. John in Romulus, Michigan, watching on Free Speech TV. Hey, John, what's up?
Hi, John. Can you hear me?
Yep. We have a minute to the end of the show, John.
Oh, we got a quick comment here. Whatever. Yeah, the lady about the Indians, that's wonderful. I donate to a couple Indian schools in Montana and South Dakota.
Good on you.
And I spoke with a lady in Montana about this pipeline,
mm-hmm.
and she's totally convinced that this is a wonderful thing. And I tried to talk to her. It was almost impossible. I've been running into people like this, you know, every week, talking about you guys and the progressive movement, and they'll think I'm nuts because they're all brainwashed.
Yeah, well, it's because they watch Fox News. Fox, you know, Rupert Murdoch was really smart. You know, MSNBC, you got to pay extra. You got to have the premium channels to get MSNBC. Fox, you can get anywhere. It's in every truck stop. It's in, you know, it's in the restaurants all over the place. It's on basic cable. And, you know, they make a little less money, but they sure do get the message out. It is, you know, Roger Ailes started Fox News with Murdoch's money, and Roger Ailes had proposed GOP TV. That's literally what they called it, GOP TV, when he worked in the Nixon administration. That's Fox News, Fox so-called news. John, thanks for the call. And then on top of that, you got, you know, right-wing talk radio everywhere. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman Program, latest news and information from Wall Street, Main Street, all the stuff you need to win the water cooler wars. Plus, we're going to continue. We're still trying to figure out, how is the Tea Party a social welfare program? Yeah. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there and get active. Do something. Go to pdamerica.org, for example. See what Tim Carpenter and the Progressive Democrats of America are up to. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.